ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 9th of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom say they're considering formal talks this year about including Japan in the so-called AUKUS Defence Partnership. That agreement allows for the sharing of secret information and high-tech weaponry among the countries and will also enable Australia to acquire nuclear-powered submarines. But they've stopped short of announcing a formal expansion of the agreement. It's expected the US President Joe Biden and Japanese PM Fumio Kishida will discuss this further when they meet in Washington later this week. China, which is no fan of the AUKUS deal, says it's gravely concerned about the prospect of Japan joining the pact. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield is at Parliament House. Evelyn, it's a consideration rather than a formal expansion of the AUKUS partnership. What's the significance of this?
Well, as you point out, at this stage it is a consideration, but nonetheless we've received a defence minister's statement. So that's a joint statement from the ministers in Australia, the US and the United Kingdom. And when they talk about engaging with other partners, Japan is the only country that they name. Now, this follows quite a bit of speculation, and US officials had been flagging an announcement on this. We even heard from America's ambassador in Tokyo writing in the Wall Street Journal last week. And it's worth noting too that the Japanese Prime Minister is also visiting Washington this week and will meet with US President Joe Biden. So in this statement from the defence ministers, they talk about the three countries seeking to maximise the strategic benefits of the AUKUS partnership to support security and stability in the Indo-Pacific region and beyond. And they say that they always intended to engage others in Pillar 2 of the AUKUS partnership. Now, Pillar 1, that's about the nuclear-powered submarines, so buying and building them. And Pillar 2 is about advanced capabilities, and that's the one we're talking about. So developing and providing capabilities, mainly around technology, there's mention too. So things like AI and electronic warfare. So really pointing out that technology innovation is something that the countries are looking at when they're looking at partners for Pillar 2.
And Evelyn, Japan potentially joining this AUKUS pact would be, well, clearly aimed at countering China's growing influence in the region. What is Beijing saying about that, if anything?
What we've heard from China so far is that it has grave concerns about this prospect of Japan joining the AUKUS partnership. So the Chinese Foreign Ministry has reportedly told the South China Morning Post that this would intensify the arms race in the Indo-Pacific region and disrupt regional peace and stability.
Evelyn Manfield. For millions of Australians, the price they pay for their electricity is a known quantity. It costs the same no matter when they buy it from the grid. Imagine then the shock for some consumers who are being charged significantly more for their power at certain times of the day, but only finding out when they receive a dramatically higher bill. It's a situation that's prompted an alarmed response from consumer advocates, as National Energy reporter Daniel Mercer explains.
Angela Hyde lives a modest life near Berry, about 2.5 hours east of Adelaide on the Murray River. Money is tight, so it was a bitter blow when she recently received a quarterly power bill for $2,000, an amount that was more than double the previous invoice and unlike anything she'd ever had before.
That's a lot of money for me. I was horrified when I saw the amount and I thought, how am I going to pay this?
Angela Hyde claims the shocking bill came after changes were made to the way her property is charged for electricity. Instead of a flat rate throughout the day, she says she was being billed significantly more for power between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. and 1 a.m., 14 hours for every day. And she says she wasn't notified beforehand.
And I hadn't done anything differently. I hadn't bought any new appliances or anything that would change it except for the smart meter and the new times of use tariff.
When was the first time you actually knew about any of this?
When I got my bill.
Angela Hyde's story is an increasingly common one across Australia, but particularly in South Australia, consumers are being shifted onto time of use tariffs in big numbers. Enabling the change are smart meters that energy regulators want rolled out to every home by the end of the decade. They say the tariffs will make the grid more efficient by sending consumers price signals about the underlying cost of power, which is typically more expensive to produce in the evening when solar power is low. Angela Hyde's retailer, French-owned firm Simply Energy, declined the offer of an interview. Instead, in a statement, the company said it was the network poles and wires provider that installed the smart meter and changed the tariff. As such, Simply Energy said it had no obligation to inform the customer. It's angered Peak Community Services Group, ACOS.
We think there's a major failing here, both on the part of the regulator and on the part of the retailers who are not informing their customers that this is going on.
Ross Womersley is the head of the South Australian Council of Social Service. He says the rollout of time-of-use tariffs has been badly mishandled. Much worse, he says the tariffs are entrenching inequality and hurting many of the people who can least afford to bear it.
It's all well and good for those households that might be able to shift the time that they are switching their electrical appliances on. But if you haven't got that capacity, then you're going to actually be punished.
That's Ross Womersley from the South Australian Council of Social Service, ending that report by Daniel Mercer. And a spokesman for the Australian Energy Regulator says retailers are allowed to vary their customers' tariffs and charges as long as it's consistent with national energy rules. But the spokesman also says that customers also had to be given notice of any changes affecting them. Scientists are trying to find out the extent of damage after the Great Barrier Reef experienced its fifth mass coral bleaching in 8 years. It's now known that southern reefs are the worst affected, but it could be months before there's certainty about how much of the bleached coral has actually died. Annie Guest reports from Brisbane.
Dr. Lisa Schindler loves scuba diving on the Great Barrier Reef, but her most recent expedition wasn't good.
It was one of those things where I'd booked two dives and I sort of didn't want to go in for the second one just because, yeah, I found it quite difficult to see. As someone who's dived the Great Barrier Reef for 20 years and really passionate about it, it was, it was really hard. It was quite confronting.
Dr. Schindler is a marine ecologist and spokeswoman for the Australian Marine Conservation Society.
So we'd sort of heard because of the aerial surveys that it had been down, we knew that bleaching was to about 5 metres, but I did a dive to 10 metres and there was bleaching that was fairly extensive.
And whereabouts did you see it at that depth?
Because of the tourism operators, we're sort of not saying exactly that they're quite concerned about getting tourists cancelling on them, but it was in one of the far south reefs in the Great Barrier Reef.
And new official surveys done by aeroplane also confirmed damage in that region. Mark Reid is a spokesman for the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority.
So based on that survey, what we found is that many of the reefs in the southern Great Barrier Reef were exhibiting a fairly high extent or prevalence of bleaching.
And that's the area where water temperatures have been the highest through the summer.
The central area of the Great Barrier Reef, we had a very similar picture. And then in the northern and sort of far northern Great Barrier Reef up into the Torres Straits, those reefs were bleached less extensively.
The latest aerial survey covered 75% of the reef, finding most corals in shallow water have bleaching. That's where heat-stressed coral expels the algae that gives them their vibrant colours. But Mark Reid points out that mass bleaching doesn't necessarily mean mass coral death.
So many of the corals that have been bleached are likely to recover, regain their little algae and keep on growing. And then we'll just need to use those in-water surveys to determine whether or not there's others that haven't been able to recover.
Some of those temperatures on the Great Barrier Reef show 14 weeks of hotter than average sea surface temperatures. Is that the longest stretch? Is that a record heating event on the reef?
Look, Annie, it certainly would be up there with some of the longest we've seen in terms of the duration of those temperatures.
It could be months before there's certainty about how much of the bleached coral has died.
Any guest reporting? One of the most contentious issues in American politics, abortion rights. And until now, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, hasn't been entirely clear on where he stands. Now, in a video, Mr. Trump says it's up to the states to decide the matter. North America correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
There's much to unpick in the four-minute video Donald Trump has posted on his social media platform outlining his views on abortion rights. The headline is that the former president does not endorse a plan to try and introduce a national ban at 15 or 16 weeks, an idea he's reported to have been considering. The presumptive nominee doesn't actually address a national ban in the video statement, instead stressing it's up to the states to decide abortion rights.
And whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. Many states will be different. Many will have a different number of weeks, or some will have more conservative than others, and that's what they will be.
Donald Trump suggests where he might draw the line.
Like Ronald Reagan, I am strongly in favor of exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother.
He says fellow Republicans should make up their own minds, but then reminds them they also need to win votes.
You must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections to restore our culture and, in fact, to save our country.
Popular opposition to the tightening of abortion laws across many states in the wake of the fall of Roe v. Wade was seen as a key reason Democrats performed better than expected in the 2022 midterms. And Donald Trump appears to have recognized that extreme views could hinder his chances of securing a second term.
We must win. We have to win.
Donald Trump was arguably instrumental through his appointment of conservative judges to the Supreme Court in the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And the Biden campaign has been quick to hit back following the video statement. Campaign manager Julie Chavez Rodriguez.
Because of Trump, more than one in three women of reproductive age now live under extreme and dangerous bans. Today, Trump stated his support for those extreme bans and made clear he will support these bans in all 50 states. Make no mistake, leaving it to the states is an endorsement of the cruel and dangerous abortion bans across the country, made possible only by Donald Trump.
The Democrats were counting on attacking Republicans over reproductive rights as November's elections approach. That would likely have been easier had Donald Trump come out in support of a national ban. His statement means they'll have to work a little harder on the messaging. And 2 years after the end of Roe v. Wade, it puts abortion front and center of the 2024 campaign. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
A warning, this next report might be a bit distressing for some. Kids Helpline says there's been a sharp jump in the number of calls from young men and boys being targeted by sexual extortion online, with many experiencing distress and some with very tragic consequences. Follows the arrest of two people in Nigeria over the alleged sextortion of a 16-year-old Australian boy who took his own life. Police say the teenager shared explicit photos with someone he thought was a young woman, but instead he was threatened and told to pay a ransom to stop the images from being sent to his family and friends. John Daly reports.
There weren't too many calls to Kids Helpline about sextortion just a few years ago. Now it happens regularly.
Now we're getting, you know, at least a call every couple of days, if not more often than that.
Tony Fitzgerald is the head of Kids Helpline, which has received 431 calls in the last 6 years from kids and young adults targeted by sextortion. 66% of those occurred last year alone. Sextortion is online blackmail, in which offenders trick or coerce victims into providing explicit images and use them to make threats and demands, sometimes for money.
They're scared, they're terrified that their image might get out and they might be subject to shame or stigma. So that's what makes this crime so insidious.
Tony Fitzgerald says more than three quarters of victims are males aged 15 to 25.
Now, that's really different to the contact patterns we get for Kids Helpline generally, which is probably about 75-80% from females. So that's what makes it stand out.
New South Wales police yesterday revealed two men in Nigeria had been arrested for alleged sextortion of an Australian teenager who took his own life. Police say there's been an almost 400% increase in sextortion cases in that state in the last 18 months. Nationally, reports of image-based abuse to the eSafety Commissioner increased by 117% in the 2022-23 period. Tony Fitzgerald believes the abundance of social media and dating platforms is contributing to the rise.
You know, online scamming has been around for many, many years, but it tends to develop and evolve depending on who is the latest target. And unfortunately, our young men, our young boys, are a target at the moment.
Professor Nicola Henry researches technology-facilitated abuse at RMIT University. She says sextortion does involve international scammers, but offenders are more often known to the victim.
The perpetrator is more likely to be an intimate partner.
Regardless of the context, Nicola Henry says sexual extortion has serious consequences for victims' mental health.
And unfortunately, there have been cases, very sadly, of people taking their own lives because they just don't know what to do. They feel so ashamed. They don't know who to speak to. And it's heartbreaking.
Tony Fitzgerald from Kids Helpline says breaking down that shame barrier is vital.
Parents need to have conversations with their teenage boys now to let them know that if this does happen to them, that it's okay to talk about it.
And if it does happen, he says parents should report it to the Australian Centre to Counter Child Exploitation.
John Daly reporting there. And if the story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Australian medicinal cannabis growers say cheap, poorly regulated imported products are crippling the local industry and posing a health risk to consumers. The medical goods regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, says it can't test every batch of medicinal cannabis that comes into the country. But doctors are worried, and patients too, that their health's at risk of dangerous toxins and unknown potency of imported drugs. Tyrone Dalton reports.
Terry Russell lives with chronic pain because of a spinal condition. He moves slowly. His life essentials include a motorised scooter, crutches and cannabis oil.
I'd be in a lot worse pain, but I'm not pain-free.
The 68-year-old takes a tiny amount during the day and again just before bed.
So rather than have the opiates, I'm able to take the cannabis oil.
Terry is one of around 140,000 Australians who are prescribed medicinal cannabis by their doctors. But there are growing questions about the quality and safety of the product and the future of the Australian industry that produces it.
A lot of people aren't becoming cultivators because of the concern of the financial viability.
That was Nan-Marie Scurie, who runs a cannabis farm in northern Victoria. It's one of about 50 companies approved to grow and produce cannabis products in Australia.
There's a lot of controls in place. We do a lot of batch documents. We ensure that we track every step of the process to make sure that it's consistent, and that adds cost.
But there is double the number of companies approved to import cannabis into Australia. Nan-Marie says they are undercutting Australian companies on cost because they don't have the same kind of regulation. Peter Coetzee, the CEO of one of Australia's biggest cannabis producers, Can Group, agrees the lack of government regulation is the problem.
More product pushed into this country at a cheaper price without the kind of cost regulations and challenges that we have does create a very, very difficult situation for us to maintain our revenue growth.
There's also concern about the quality of product being imported into Australia and sold to patients. The manager of one of Australia's major laboratories for testing medicinal cannabis told the ABC up to 30% of imported cannabis products the laboratory tests is not what it claims to be on the label. Retired nurse and patient advocate from the Sunshine Coast, Lucy Haslam, says cannabis oil patients include cancer sufferers, children, and those with compromised immune systems.
It's being used as medicine, it's being sold as medicine, so we should be treating it as medicine and ensuring that it's good quality.
Six cases of patients having adverse reactions to medicinal cannabis have been reported to the Therapeutic Goods Administration since the start of medicinal cannabis in Australia, with side effects including overdoses, incontinence, nerve damage and psychosis. Steve Robson is the president of the Australian Medical Association.
We're certainly hearing stories about these issues, about quality issues and adverse responses. And that should trigger concern in the community.
Regulatory body, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, says it has noticed a big jump in the number of Australians using medicinal cannabis since it was legalised in 2019. And at a conference in Melbourne last month, the TGA's Catherine Clark told the audience the regulator was not doing routine testing, and more than that, it wasn't its job.
Tyrone Dalton reporting there, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. We're meant to be transitioning to a greener future and getting rid of gas for good, but now we're talking about drilling for more of it. Today, energy reporter Dan Mercer explains how we've ended up here. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.